This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. What does it mean to say that a community has a philanthropic character? That's the question at the beginning of a report from Grand Valley State University on patterns of giving in Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids. The researchers looked at what causes major donors give to, how they choose to be acknowledged or not, and how coordinated that giving is. We are joined in studio by Grand Valley State University political science professor Michelle Miller Adams. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here, Gordon.
And Michael Moody is the Frye Foundation chair at GVSU's Johnson Center for Family Philanthropy, and he joins us by phone. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Let me turn to both of you for maybe just a quick summary for both of these communities. How are Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids similar when it comes to their philanthropic giving? Michelle?
The communities are really quite similar in a lot of ways. Grand Rapids, of course, is larger, but both communities have a base of wealthy individuals who essentially made their money in those communities and remained local and have chosen to reinvest their wealth in the community to make the community a better place to live, better for business, better for residents, more attractive to people considering moving there. So that's a fundamental similarity. Both communities are also quite philanthropic relative to national averages, but there are some important differences in the way philanthropists in the two communities go about their business. So we were looking at both the similarities and the differences in this report.
Michael?
Yeah, and I guess the thing I would say is that it's very difficult to measure philanthropy in a community, either even talking about how much money is given in a community. It's very difficult to measure that. And also this idea that each community has in some ways this less tangible but very important philanthropic character to it, where there's just sort of these patterns and norms to how people give in communities and who gives to what and how they prefer to give. And so that's really what we were trying to get at in this report, and to do so in a couple of communities that we know well, to sort of try out this way of assessing that character and assessing, you know, the patterns in the giving. You had mentioned, you know, how they compare to other communities. It's very hard for us to say, well, Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids are number, you know, either two or number 25 or number 200 in terms of where they rank in giving. What we can say is they are extremely proud philanthropic communities, and philanthropy plays a major role in both communities in ways that we definitely do not see in a lot of other similar-sized communities around the country. So I think they were good subjects for this kind of an analysis because philanthropy really is so present and important in both places.
And I think it's also important to highlight here what we were not looking at. We were really looking at the activities of wealthy individuals, of major donors, foundations. We did not look at other really important aspects of philanthropic character that might include, we didn't look at, for example, United Way campaigns. We didn't look at volunteer hours. We were really focused on this notion that the wealthiest individuals in a community do things in certain ways that may tell us something about the philanthropic character of that community. And as Michael said, we had to really think about what data sources were available, what kind of methods were appropriate to ask that question.
There's a question that you get at in here about whether or not donors want to be recognized. And of course, Michelle, you have written quite a bit on one of the more famous gift by anonymous donors, the Kalamazoo Promise. The donors to this day, almost 12 years since it was announced, have chosen not to be named. What are the reasons that someone would want to give money, perhaps, you know, for something like college scholarships or maybe to build something, and yet would not want their name to be associated with it?
Okay, so that's a hard question because, of course, they're anonymous.
They're anonymous, so you can't ask them, right?
But there are some, you know, really good reasons. I think a lot of donors want to stay out of the nitty-gritty, stay away from the day-to-day operations of the philanthropy that they're contributing to. And so that's a good way to do that is to give anonymously. Another reason might be to avoid any conversation about whether there are overt or subtle conflicts of interest. That can be helpful as well. And, you know, in the case of the Kalamazoo Promise, I think our donors understood intuitively that this was going to need to be a community-wide endeavor. And by remaining anonymous, they essentially invited the community to step in and step up and play a role. But we did learn something, I learned something really important about named giving through this project that I think Michael already knew, but I learned it, which is that it's usually not the donors who want to be named. It's usually the recipient institution that asks donors if they can attach a name, because that really helps them with their development efforts.
I found that part interesting because there was also a comment that sometimes there is backlash against the donors that's in the eyes of this person you quoted just isn't really deserved, because they often have to be persuaded that their name should be on whatever it is that they have given money to. Michael?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where we shouldn't make an assumption that if somebody has their name attached to a gift in some way, their name is on the building, or, you know, or in really any number of things that can be named, as we know, particularly in Grand Rapids, a lot of things get names attached to them. We shouldn't assume that that's an ego-driven sort of desire for recognition on the part of the donor. And certainly that happens in some cases, right? But certainly what we heard when we did this research in Grand Rapids was that very often it was a matter of convincing the donor to go public, to overcome those incentives to be anonymous, which Michelle started to describe some of those, and to overcome in some ways what may be a sort of a humility that they bring to the giving, and their reasons for giving, for example, religious reasons for giving and others, would encourage people to be humble and not to promote themselves in the giving so that it's more of a selfless act. But what then explains, if it's not ego and hubris, what explains the names on all sorts of things? It's really this dynamic that they found that, particularly in Grand Rapids, they found that named giving works to build campaigns for other people to give even more so that the size of the giving can increase through these patterns of, for example, having some major names of prominent trusted philanthropists in the community attached to a campaign early on. And in some ways, it gives a sort of a seal of approval that, you know, that you assume if you're a mid-range donor, you assume that because these one or two major donors are so prominently associated with naming the building that you're being asked to contribute to, you can assume that they've taken a close look at it, that their people have taken a close look at it, that they believe in the mission and in the project. In some ways, it's sort of a shorthand analysis that you can make of that this is a good philanthropic investment for you.
The word trusted kind of stood out to me there in what you just said, that people will look at a name and say, well, if they gave their money, then we assume they did due diligence, and we assume that they know that this is a proper cause that is worth giving money to.
Yeah, and you know, the political, you know, sort of side of this, of course, can come in at certain times. But I think when people are looking, when we're talking about sort of these campaigns and where multiple donors are giving, people can look across the political aisles and say, okay, well, I may disagree with that person, you know, in our local politics, but we're both focused on the good of the community. I do know that they want what's best for our community, and I know that they're, you know, probably good business people or others who can do an analysis of are the finances going to make sense on this. And so you can trust them in that sense, even those who otherwise are on opposite sides of a political fence.
I think naming is also related to this issue of donor coordination, which I expect that Gordon will be getting to momentarily. And I should add that it's in Kalamazoo. It's not like there's no naming that goes on here. And the university is, I think, very conscious of the benefits of a naming strategy. And in Grand Rapids, we discovered that our university, Grand Valley, was really one of the most active namers of buildings for philanthropists. So universities are very involved in this.
Well, let's move to that question of coordinated giving or collaboration amongst donors. That seems to happen more in Grand Rapids than in Kalamazoo. What's the result of that?
I think that in Grand Rapids, the model of philanthropy that has been developed there, this philanthropic character, is highly efficient. So not only are people willing and asked when willing or eager to attach their names to projects, there is this sort of reciprocity. You support my project, I support your project. I build a hospital, you build a cancer center, et cetera, et cetera. And that goes hand in hand with the really quite overt level of coordination that major donors in Grand Rapids carry out, particularly through the Grand Action Organization, which is an organization that has worked toward a number of really important infrastructure projects in Grand Rapids that have really been largely responsible for transforming the landscape of downtown. It is much harder, and that is a political action committee as well that works to claim public money from Lansing, from the state. It's much harder to envision that kind of coordinated public strategy that yields public-private partnerships in a place like Kalamazoo, where so much of the giving is done under the radar. So I think those are some of the results. We have a lot of wonderful philanthropic resources in Kalamazoo, but we haven't seen that kind of ongoing coordinated giving that you have seen in donor coordination that you've seen in Grand Rapids. Oddly enough, the Kalamazoo Promise is an activity of multiple donors who coordinated their work but opted to remain anonymous.
Michael?
Yeah, I think the main punchline of this message around coordination is that in Grand Rapids, they have just discovered that overt public coordination among multiple donors works. It's been successful. And I think of the first couple of projects that they did that sort of coordination, you know, things like the convention center and the Van Andel Arena, if they tried for some really big public community project with multiple that required donor coordination in an overt way and leveraging public dollars, if that had really not gone that well, I don't know that we would see the same level of coordination among donors in Grand Rapids. I think the fact that it worked, that it has worked in Grand Rapids, really made it into a pattern that has really thrived and continued. I think the other thing that's going on is this sense of public spiritedness that they share across donors who have multiple different interests. You know, the alternative to this sort of coordination among donors in a city like Grand Rapids would be everybody does their sort of pet project and pet organization. You know, they've got this one family supports the symphony, this other family supports charter schools. They occasionally give to each other's campaigns, but mostly they don't really, they just focus on what they're most passionate about. And what we see going on in Grand Rapids is that people, major donors, are often giving to causes that they wouldn't otherwise give to because there is this sort of coordinated activity among multiple donors toward that goal. And what drives that is not necessarily, we found, a sort of an old school, you scratch my back, I scratch your back kind of quid pro quo, which is, you know, a classic fundraising technique. And there is some of that that goes on. But mostly what it is that we both share, even with our different passions, we both share this commitment to doing what's right for the community, and we both see the benefit to our family, our businesses, which are often family businesses, and other things of working toward these good projects for the community. So, you know, it's not purely other-directed or non-self-interested. There is a little bit of sort of self-interest here in the sense that they want to live in a community where businesses thrive and businesses like theirs can thrive.
Is it unique for a community to have multiple generations that come from the same family giving large donations to projects in that area, even after the corporations that those families, you know, might have come from have, you know, moved out of the area or been absorbed in a merger? You know, Michael, is it something that Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids both share? And I wonder if we would find it in many communities across the country.
Yes, I think the response is a complicated one because there's the question of, do the next generations of these major families in communities want to continue to be engaged as philanthropists in their community? And the answer to that is clearly yes. I've been doing many years of research on another project on the next generation of major donors across the country. And that's clearly the case, that the next generation does not want to give up on the communities in which their families have been major donors for many years. And they are engaged in sort of stewarding the legacy of their family in those communities. What's different, though, and this is why I say it's complicated, is that they may not necessarily want to give in the same way. And I think that goes to the questions we're raising in this report around philanthropic character of a community. The philanthropic character of the community may very well start to change as these next generations of these families become more involved because they, in general, want to give in different ways. For example, they're more interested in solutions that really sort of blur the boundaries between a nonprofit and a for-profit. So they're, you know, promoting social entrepreneurship or creating a startup incubator or other things instead of just giving a big donation to the big hospital campaign. That's more exciting to the next generation. So I think you're going to see in both of these communities The next generation will clearly continue to be involved, but they may be involved in different ways. And I think the fundraisers and nonprofits, for example, are going to have to adjust how they engage these major families because the next generation want to be engaged in different ways.
Does it matter when people move out of the area? In other words, if someone decides that Kalamazoo or Grand Rapids is not the place where they want to live out their adulthood and raise a family, et cetera, is there still a tie that that family may have back to their hometown, especially if they were a prominent member of a prominent family in that town, and therefore can perhaps still be called upon for a donation or some help when it's needed?
I guess, again, I would say it's complicated, but I would say in general, if the next generation member of a family doesn't live in the community in which that family has been giving over many years and is so significant as a philanthropic family in that community, there's both, if you will, a sort of an emotional or moral kind of motivation for them to be engaged, and there's often an organizational sort of incentive for them to be engaged. The moral and the emotional one is they really do believe and are very proud of their family's legacy. So even if they live in Pittsburgh, I don't know if anybody from a major family in Kalamazoo actually lives in Pittsburgh as the next generation, but if they live in Pittsburgh and that's where they have their professional lives in their home, but their family is really a prominent donor family that's done many great things in Kalamazoo or Grand Rapids, they are going to be pulled back to want to continue that legacy. Sometimes there's an organizational reason for it also, because they may have established a family foundation that is going to be located there and serve in perpetuity to give in that community. And we find that the next generation, if they're living in Florida or California or wherever, they are interested in coming back and being a part of that giving institution, that foundation or donor advised fund or other things that's committed to that local area.
Speaking of legacies, this report gets into the history of the Upjohn Company in Kalamazoo and its role in sort of creating a culture of philanthropy. Now, of course, the Upjohn Company merged with Pharmacia. Ultimately, that was bought by Pfizer. So how much did that change and how much does the legacy remain intact from what the Upjohn Company set forth so many decades ago in Kalamazoo?
The Upjohn Company legacy in Kalamazoo is hugely important. And as you know, Gordon, my other job is at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. That's one little piece of the legacy. The Community Foundation began as a project of the Upjohn Company. The various philanthropies in town, arts organizations, their endowments came directly from the Upjohn Company, Upjohn Company employees. Our arts and cultural infrastructure and philanthropic infrastructure in Kalamazoo owes a huge debt to the Upjohn Company. And of course, there are still Upjohn heirs in the community, although they don't bear that name, that are extremely active in philanthropy. And it's a great example of next generation giving. The Upjohn Company is gone, the Upjohn name is gone, but the Upjohn heirs are active and engaged philanthropists. This also explains in part, well, we don't really exactly want to say explain, but we did notice something, you know, very interesting in looking at the structure of giving in these two communities. In Grand Rapids, wealthy donors are more likely to set up their own family foundation than in Kalamazoo. In Kalamazoo, we have a handful of family foundations and a very large community foundation, in part because that community foundation is part of that Upjohn Company legacy. The foundation was started with Upjohn Company stock. In Grand Rapids, the landscape of family foundations looks quite different.
Well, I would just say that that's an example of when we say there are patterns that develop in communities, and they're driven by, you know, what may seem for some people to be ancient history, you know, where things started, how organizations or institutions started in community. People look at that and they say, well, that was back in the 30s or the 50s. That didn't really influence how we give today. But in fact, that's not how cultures and traditions work, right? That's not really even how communities work. They have memories. They have ways of talking about themselves that endure. And I think that's clearly what goes on in terms of a community's philanthropic character, its sense of itself as a philanthropic place, is that they talk about themselves that way. The patterns get established by those historical sort of facts, and those sort of evolve down that path. And I think what you have going on, and various sort of mechanisms reinforce that, you know, people, when they're making choices, they sell a business and they're making a choice about what they're going to do philanthropically. They look to their immediate neighbors, and they look to what they know about how their community works to make a decision about, oh, well, I'm then going to make a big gift to this college, or I'm going to establish a perpetual foundation, or I'm going to give through the community foundation.
So there are some areas of interest that both communities seem to share in terms of the money given. Education is one, arts is another. But are there differences within that? In other words, where the money goes when it comes to education? As of yet, there's not a Grand Rapids Promise. So is the money going to different areas within, say, education or within the arts?
Let me say a word about education. This is one of the reasons why we added these case studies to this report, where we could compare what the philanthropic landscape looks like in through a couple of organizations in each community. And there is a small pilot promise type program. It's small, it's very generous, but it's small only in that it's confined to one high school in Grand Rapids. It's called the Challenge Scholars. It's funded by the Community Foundation and many of its donors. So that was very much modeled on the Kalamazoo Promise, but it's smaller scale. I notice some pretty major differences when you talk about education, and that's in part because of the size of the Kalamazoo Promise and it's the fact that it's going to continue in perpetuity. The Kalamazoo Promise is a really open-ended intervention. As we talked about earlier, the donors put the money down and didn't really walk away, but have stayed remarkably quiet and watched the system respond. In Grand Rapids, there is a lot of funding for education, but it is more traditional types of funding to support various enrichment programs, extracurricular programs, support for students in the public schools. And of course, there's a heavy, heavy emphasis on charter and religious education that is largely missing in Kalamazoo. There's very little of that put your money in and see what happens as well. Particularly in the education field, the major educational interventions like the Challenge Scholars, there are a couple of others as well, are actively managed by donors, studied, evaluated, managed more closely in a way than the Kalamazoo Promise is. The Kalamazoo Promise was really intended as this transformational investment through an open-ended investment in public education, and that's quite different from what education philanthropy looks like in Grand Rapids.
Michael?
Yeah, I think Michelle knows that field really well, and her analysis is spot on there. I think I would just make a general point that in many of these areas that we talk about, that we use as examples, arts, education, downtown development, we see these patterns that we find in both places, patterns around coordinated giving, around religious giving, around anonymous versus named giving, these things we've talked about. We see those illustrated in all of those areas in a way that I think helps us to say, okay, well, that is a pattern that goes on. It's not just a random, occurrence that they developed the Kalamazoo Promise in the way that they did, or that giving to education happens the way that it does in Grand Rapids. Those follow these patterns. And the other thing I'll say is that back to the next generation thing, those patterns may continue in terms of coordinated strategic activity in Grand Rapids, for example, and more anonymous giving by major donors in Kalamazoo. But we do have this transition to the next generation that's happening, and I do think you're going to see some, just because there are previous patterns does not mean there are not new patterns, new patterns will not arise, and they certainly are going to, I think. We see that in the arts, for example, less giving. The future of the arts in Grand Rapids in some ways is around things like Art Prize and less around building new buildings, although that will surely continue. But the emphasis is going to be these sort of creative, multi-sector kind of engagements that we see like around Art Prize, which is, by the way, driven by the next generation of one of the major families.
Ross family, correct.
Yeah, and yeah. I think, Michael made some really good points about some of the differences with the next generation. There is this little bit more entrepreneurial spirit, perhaps more risk-taking, maybe less focused on buildings and on campaigns, perhaps a little more geared toward human capital investments. And we see that in Grand Rapids as well as Kalamazoo. So those patterns may evolve as the next generation comes into its own.
The report notes that you were getting ready to go to press when the Foundation for Excellence in Kalamazoo was announced, which is a large donation by a couple of very businessmen, Bill Johnston and Bill Parfit, and then a foundation that's supposed to get started with donations that include people from around Kalamazoo. Anybody can contribute. Do you see this, Michelle, as being similar to the pattern that Kalamazoo has followed before, or is this different in any significant way?
I think this donation, if it had not been given to a public entity, would have been an anonymous donation. I think the donors, once again, are not interested in the details of what happens with the money. They've been very clear about some pieces of it, but the money has been given to the city for all kinds of reasons. The donors have been extremely far back from that. So I think in that sense, again, this is designed as an innovative, transformational investment. And it is also designed to continue in perpetuity. The idea is to fundamentally, for the long term, transform a set of incentives in Kalamazoo. And in that sense, it's very, very much like the promise. So I see it in keeping with the patterns of philanthropic culture here as well.
The report stresses several times that this is not the end of the story. So if you could pick the next thing to study, what would it be? Michael, you want to start?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, we've been talking quite a bit about, and that is, how are these patterns going to change as the next generation takes over these giving families, particularly in places like this in which it is many, but still a relative few number of prominent families? So it's more than one. When I say many, it's more than one in each place. But, you know, the next generations of those families, and as they come on, that's clearly going to be an important transition. And I think that's important for us to continue to look at. And the second thing I would say is, I think Michelle mentioned it at the beginning, which is that we really focused here, for good analytical reason, on the major families and the major donors and the biggest level of giving in each of these communities, because that does tend to drive a lot of big investments and drive the sort of philanthropic patterns. But they are not the only ones who are part of and make up the philanthropic character of each of these communities. And so I think if there's some way for us to begin to look at how does that philanthropic character get reflected in multiple levels of the society, if you will, sort of across socioeconomic status in different sorts of communities, you know, immigrant communities, for example, or communities of color, across the differences that we clearly find in these two diverse communities, what are the interesting differences and similarities in the philanthropic characters of those different parts of each of the communities? I think that's a fascinating question, not just in our two communities, but in any place we try to understand the philanthropic character of that community.
Michelle?
Yeah, I think another really interesting question is whether one can take this approach and look at other communities in a rigorous way. And I think the answer is yes. I can imagine really interesting analogous studies of, say, Ann Arbor, Battle Creek, Detroit, Flint, Traverse City, just here in Michigan. You know, one of the questions for me is, once you get to a certain size of a city, it probably stops making sense to talk about a philanthropic character. So as someone who lived in big cities for a long time, I think it would be pretty hard to define the philanthropic character of, say, New York City or Los Angeles.
But there might be several.
There would
of them,
be multiple.
Words, yeah.
Exactly. They might be regional. They might be sectoral. There are a lot of different ways that you could cut that. And then very small towns might look a little bit different as well, in that they might just have one donor or perhaps no foundation. So we are probably looking at a methodology that works best at mid-sized cities, although there are a lot of those and they range widely, but perhaps not in very large cities or very, very small communities.
Michelle Miller Adams is a political science professor at Grand Valley State University. She has joined us in studio. And Michael Moody is the Fry Foundation Chair at GVSU's Johnson Center for Family Philanthropy. He joined us by phone. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Thank you.
You can find links to Grand Valley State University's study on the philanthropic contributions of Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids at WMUK.org. A programming note, we're going to be bringing you some rebroadcasts of previous programs for the next few weeks. Some of them will be longer versions of the interviews that originally aired. We plan to have new programs on again in August. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.